In this episode of The Ownership Economy, we speak with Molecule Protocol's co-founder and chief scientific officer, Tyler Galato. Molecule is creating collaborative ecosystems where stakeholders in drug development can work together to expedite the process of bringing novel therapeutics to patients. The company is connecting leading researchers to funding by turning intellectual property and its development into a liquid and easily investable asset. We talk with Tyler about the model, how the company is approaching progressive decentralization, and where algorithmic rules of governance intersect with the need for human decision-making. We hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome, Tyler. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we like to start these interviews out just by hearing a little bit about your background, your origin story. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Start wherever you want to.
Yeah, so I started out my career wanting to be a physician and sort of like went into that space relatively bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. My sister spent a lot of time in the hospital when she was born with a condition called RSV. So when I was about 5 years old, I had a lot of exposure to physicians. I spent a lot of time in hospitals and sort of had this early imprinting experience that I wanted to be a doctor. But my parents were not in medicine or anything like this. It was all a bit abstract. Pursued that for quite some time, developed a general interest in clinical oncology. So was doing the early parts of an MD-PhD program, so sort of this physician-scientist track. And through that process, and also by spending a lot of time in hospitals and just sort of understanding medicine, really came to the realization that medicine itself is an extremely applied science. And it's also very primitive, meaning that presently, other than infectious disease, communicable disease, we don't really know how to cure anything. Maybe some stuff with surgery, but for the most part, we manage chronic conditions. And this realization really came to light for me, particularly in the oncology space, where if you're treating an intractable cancer like pancreatic cancer or glioblastoma, which were some of my research interests, and you apply the standard of care, you have just a known range of outcomes. People survive for 6 to 8 weeks, depending on the time of diagnosis. And so sort of became acutely aware that if I wanted to do something and have an impact on the space, I probably needed to go into research and figure out how to push the field forward rather than just doing applied medicine. I really became more interested in this. I became interested in translational drug development. I did a fellowship in experimental therapeutics at Columbia University, where I was working in this really interesting bench-to-bedside paradigm. One, working in a research environment in a laboratory where we were basically dreaming up novel drug combinations and drug cocktails to treat cancer, specifically chemotherapy resistance. And on the other side of it, rapidly testing those drugs in a clinical population in the context of late-stage clinical trials. And while I was at Columbia, I noticed a couple of things that had a really profound impact on me and the trajectory for the rest of my career. So in Washington Heights in New York, where Columbia's medical center is, there is a large Dominican population that is chronically underinsured and also has a relatively high incidence of pancreatic cancer. And one thing that I observed was that people would come to the medical center to try and participate in these clinical trials, and some of them didn't have health insurance. And if they didn't qualify for the clinical trial, they didn't meet the inclusion criteria, they wouldn't be able to participate in the clinical trial, and they also wouldn't get treatment because they didn't have health insurance. And in the US, cancer is not it's not considered an emergency, it's not an acute condition. If you don't have health insurance and you show up somewhere, they don't have to treat you. And so this was a really shocking realization sort of early on in my career in one of the wealthiest countries in the world, one of the wealthiest cities, one of the wealthiest medical centers. There's sort of people who are falling through the gaps and not able to get treatment. And on the other side of it, the PI that I was working with, primary investigator, a guy called Robert Fine, he was really interested. His research practice had functionally changed over time to really be focused on trying to develop just really cheap therapies to fight cancer, which is interesting. Instead of doing like the most cutting edge science, the thought was rather, okay, how do I just get the cheapest off-patent drug combinations and try to get them to patients? So you could see even early on there that there were some intrinsic issues and some sort of perverse incentives that existed in the context of the US healthcare system that dictated not only how medicine reached patients, but also how like medicines were researched and developed. And physicians were this is relatively early on in my career. I'm just sort of doing a fellowship at this stage, but progressively I became a bit disenchanted with cancer research in general. I also noticed that our healthcare system is super reactive, meaning that we focus primarily on on treating, not preventing. And I sort of became more interested in prevention. So I ended up transitioning into biogerontology, which is the science of aging. I joined the National Institutes of Health at the National Institute on Aging in an intramural research lab, a government laboratory focused on DNA damage and repair, oxidative stress. Instead, thinking about how, rather than like treating cancer, what if we could prevent mutation entirely? So started to become interested in these sort of paradigms. Spent a couple of years at NIH. It's an amazing place to do science. You don't have to apply for grants. You have a budget. It's checked every 4 years. It's largely not indicative of the way that science functions, in that if I'm an academic, it's like publish or perish. I was thinking about, you know, I would love to continue doing science in this context, but, you know, this would be, you know, and a lot of people do this who work at NIH. You basically work your entire life to stay an NIH researcher working in a government laboratory, but doesn't offer the same flexibility in some context. So anyway, while I was there, and this is, sorry, I have like a very sort of nonlinear career. I'll get to crypto eventually. While I was there, I sort of had the realization that I had spent, you know, most of my career focused on diseases of affluence, things like cancer, things like aging. I became more interested in understanding a different side of healthcare. I did a sub-fellowship in health disparities, ended up having the opportunity to go to South Africa and work on HIV vaccine development. So again, completely different context from the US healthcare system. While I was there, sort of had the realization that like HIV in South Africa was not really a medical problem. It was a problem of trust. It was a sociological problem, an anthropological problem. Became frustrated with that. And anyway, it was at this point in my life where I was like, okay, I don't really want to be a physician. I don't really want to be a researcher. I would love to do something on a systems level. I would love to figure out a way to like actually have a material impact on, you know, this system that is quite broken, particularly in the context of places like the United States. And at the time, was actually lamenting my frustrations to a mutual friend of my co-founder and I. He was basically the CTO of my co-founder's previous company. I produce electronic music and I DJ, and this guy had like the first store for modular synthesizers in South Africa. And I was at his modular synthesizer store and talking to him about like basically complaining about the work that I was doing in South Africa. And he was like, you know what, dude, you should really talk to the CEO of my company. He's been playing around with this, you know, sort of idea of figuring out, and this is in like 2018. So this is pre-NFT boom, like CryptoKitties is like the primary use case. There's no decentralized science space. He was basically like, you should chat to my CEO. He's been looking at ways to do like fundraising for, he wants to like change the intellectual property system. He's been looking at ways to do like fundraising using like NFTs and bonding curves for new medicines. And so I was like, okay, was vaguely interested in crypto, had like, you know, bought psychedelics on the internet in like 2013 or something, had this sort of like my entry point into crypto. I think like a lot of other people was, you know, this is interesting. Well, wow, this is cool. But like then not paying attention to it closely for years and not realizing like the material implications of it. Met Paul, jammed for like 4 months on what I thought at the time was like a completely crazy idea, because I think it was way ahead of its time, just to be frank, like envisioning Web3 and crypto in general in this context. But I thought the idea was that he had, you know, was just crazy enough to make sense. If we could, you know, if we really put our heads together, we could probably figure something out. Ended up dropping what I was doing. And started on this journey of building Molecule, which is, you know, now we're almost 5 years into it since then. First couple of years were a huge amount of learning, but I'll pause there and yeah, we can go wherever you guys want to next.
Yeah, cool. Well, so much there. I kind of want to pull up your EDM music and, and kind of put that on. I actually did pull it up while you were talking.
It's like 3 a.m. techno.
Awesome.
Maybe not for right
now. I'll put it on the next time that I'm feeling, you know, uninspired and I need some inspiration. It's so funny you mentioned the Dominican thing, because I was living in Santo Domingo for 3 years and the DR. There's like a million Dominicans in New York, or like 750,000, and they would always fly down to get serious medical treatment, because the cost of a plane ticket was less than the cost of treatment.
That's like a beautiful, like, you know, there was a story about like insurance companies literally like paying to fly people to Mexico to get like healthcare down there. Like that for me is like the sort of tagline for the US healthcare system, right? Like if you want to understand how broken it is, the fact that it's often cheaper to do like a 2 week vacation to somewhere nice in the world, really treat yourself and get like cheaper care is like what I think would be the primary thing that most people need to know to understand that the system is broken.
Yeah, crazy. So tell us a little bit about Molecule and what you guys are up to, and how the platform, how the protocol works.
Yeah, so there's, I would say, three discrete components to what we're building at the moment. And alone, each of them, I think, is quite interesting, but together, it's sort of more interesting. So on one side, it's this new legal primitive called an IPNFT, which is basically a way to move ownership or even future rights in intellectual property on chain. And we really have built this framework around the use case of therapeutic-specific IP. It works structurally by trying to replicate the real-world legal nuances of doing sponsored research agreements. I won't get too into the weeds, but maybe just to give you a sense of how it works. You have two parties, a funder or a sponsor, and let's say a research institution. The funder wants to sponsor research at this university, and in exchange for that sponsorship and in exchange for that funding, they will be the material owner of the intellectual property that originates from this contract. So what an IPNFT allows us to do is to basically take that legal contract that would exist between those two parties, move it on chain. And within the contract, there's basically a sublicensing clause or an assignment clause that means that anyone who becomes the wallet owner of that NFT would be assigned the rights of that contract. So it's actually a relatively simple innovation. It's just a way to take legal ownership or future rights in intellectual property and move it on chain. But where it becomes interesting is you now have a composable piece of intellectual property that you can use as a Lego block in DeFi. You can create a market around it. You can also attach a decentralized storage layer to it. You could have the NFT itself act as the key to access all of the raw data that, for example, is associated with the research project. And so at a first layer, what it allows us to do is bring liquidity into a sort of previously illiquid space and now begin to think about, okay, we're making IP digital, we're turning it into an asset, and now that asset is composable, it's fractionalizable, and because of that, I could begin to use ownership in IP as an incentive, meaning that if I, for example, am developing a drug, and I have a laboratory, you know, in, let's say, New York, that wants to contribute meaningful work to that drug, I can now say, great, please perform mouse studies, or please perform X or Y assay on this drug. And in exchange, I'll give you like a programmatic piece of ownership in the IP for contributing to it, right? So that's one side. You have this new asset class. The second thing we're doing is creating a marketplace for those assets. So you have, for example, a supply side that consists of researchers all over the world at different universities that are developing interesting early stage preclinical innovations. And on the other side, a pretty diverse demand side, maybe a patient advocacy group, maybe a pharmaceutical company, maybe a biotech VC, or more interestingly, and this is also now the third category and where we're doing a lot of engineering, maybe biotech DAO. These are new organizations that we're helping to create that really take care of the governance side of the equation and really getting to, like, if we think about why Molecule, why does this exist? What is the mission? What is the vision? The idea isn't just to create liquidity around IP. The goal is to really change stakeholder and ownership dynamics in medicine, right? So if you look at pharmaceutical companies intrinsically optimize for profits. And it's not because they're intrinsically evil. It's because this is the system that we have. These are public companies with shareholders, with growth expectations, and curing disease is not really a sustainable business model. What is a sustainable business model is like treating someone every day for the rest of their life for arthritis, right? Like that's a home run. Managing a chronic condition is a home run. There was a beautiful, you know, there was this use case.
Just to interrupt on that, I remember going back to my like 5-year HBS reunion and like people were so excited about dialysis, you know, which is just like, it's like a horrible business model. Right?
Outset medical, all these
sociopathic business model, right?
Yeah, for sure. Well, actually, sorry to get on top of that too. Like, you're 100% right that it's not like because people are necessarily evil, although there is some evil shit that happens, but it's really an isolated case here or there. It's just, I really want to focus on this because few people really understand, and I feel like you guys really get this. When you're sitting in a room with pharmaceutical marketers, I'm not talking about the people who design the ads. I'm talking about the people who are the market makers, the product marketing managers, the people who say, what product are we releasing and what is the economics of it in 10 years? Those people start with assumptions, to get super specific here, around number needed to treat, so that they can then say, if the NNT is this triple digit number, that's not feasible. It needs to be a 4 or 5 digit number, because as NNT goes up, That dictates what is the addressable market for our drug. The problem with that is that as NNT goes up, and efficacy of a drug also goes down. And so like you're sitting here going, why do our drugs become shittier and shittier with more side effects and less targeting and all that? It's baked into the economics, right? So like, I think this is a really important thing to stress for people to understand.
And it's just a bunch of people doing their job. Like, I mean, that's the thing. It's not some person running at the head of a pharmaceutical company that's like, hey, how do we exploit patients? It's just exactly. a bunch of people trying to do their job, right? And so unfortunately, yep. the reality is that like, and we've seen this play out, like there was a case with, I don't remember the exact pharmaceutical company, but it was in 2018, there was this like Goldman Sachs analyst that wrote this article, like, is curing diseases a sustainable business model? And they basically talked about
yes.
a case where there's like a hepatitis C drug that came to market that could cure hepatitis C.
Exactly.
But it also killed one of the chronic treatments that was like a pretty strong performing drug in the company's portfolio. And like, yeah, I think their credit rating got downgraded. It's just like this sort of like, this is like the real world implications of like this, the intersection between hypercapitalism, late stage capitalism, and healthcare, right? So anyway, how do you change that? Well, DAOs, these organizations, the idea is like, well, what if the core stakeholders, the owners of the intellectual property, were not the pharmaceutical companies necessarily, but rather the end users, or rather the researchers? What if insulin was collectively owned by diabetics or diabetic advocacy groups? What if a drug for a rare disease was actually governed and owned the intellectual property by a patient advocacy groups, by parents of sick kids? How would they price a drug? How would they treat access? What would the differences be there? And so this is, DAOs, as we envision them in this context, are basically an intersection between patient communities, researchers communities, domain experts, IP lawyers, enthusiasts, anyone who wants to come together, contribute either funding or resources or their time in exchange for governance in an organization that's going to work to basically develop drugs in a sustainable way and reinvest the proceeds back into the treasury to do additional research. And so these are the three pillars. There's this IPNFT framework, this marketplace, and then these basically supply bootstrapping and demands bootstrapping entities that you could, if you wanted to think about it from a pure like business lens, it would be like the DAOs in some way, or like the go-to-market for this IPNFT protocol. But the intention is really to figure out a way to just show that drug development can be decentralized, and that the users and the people who are creating the most value, whether it's driving innovation on the research side or the end consumer, the patient, should probably have a bit more skin in the game and a bit more stake in a process that is basically living off of, in many cases, exploitation of both of those groups at the moment. And what's interesting is, and many people don't realize this, but drug development is already decentralized, just in a very monopolized way, meaning that pharmaceutical companies over the past 20 years have vertically disintegrated. They don't do much in-house R&D anymore. They actually just go to universities, they outsource innovation, they leverage contract research organizations, and they control this pipeline. So we're basically trying to create like foundational infrastructure for other people to get involved.
Absolutely. And that pipeline too, to drill into that a little bit too, like people have asked me, hey, and you know, this is my chance to say disclosure, I invested in Molecule. And people ask me like, why did you do that? How do you make sense of it? And for me, it's as simple as what you said with the pipeline, right? They are decentralizing it. And there's a long tail of biotech companies that produce IP, when a, you know, investment manager at one Pfizer or what have you can look out there and go, well, it looks like we think that this is undervalued and the IP for this company as exhibited by its market cap is actually worth X when it's actually on the market for, you know, 500 million and we should buy that. And so like, there isn't a lot of this in-house drug development happening here anymore. It's been decentralized. And of course that brings you back to the number needed to treat argument, the efficacy, the effect size of drugs. And what ends up happening is you're running the simulation every day and going, oh, well, it looks like we're only producing drugs that have monstrous market caps that can return $12 billion over 10 years, right? And that's just the operation of the system. No one's doing anything evil, like you said, right? It's just what it does. And, you know, for me, it's very, and maybe we'll get into this now is, you know, how do you get viability for drugs below this $500 million market cap area, right? Like, how do you produce IP that can be owned by a group that then is like, you know, it's not going to be this moonshot that has to pay all these shareholders back, but is still valuable, right?
100%. Exactly.
So before we get into the DAO, right? So you talk about these three kind of areas where Molecule is kind of performing a core service, right? One is bringing down the transaction cost associated with the IP agreements. And I want to get into exactly what you're doing, because the second is kind of marketplace and discovery. And the third is supply and demand bootstrapping. And the supply and demand bootstrapping will go into a case study on VitaDAO and go into kind of details on it. But just in terms of the first one, of bringing down the transaction cost associated with IP, how exactly are you doing that, right? I mean, because this, you could do this in a Web2 framework in some regard by creating templatized agreements. And so what does the NFT actually bring to the table here? And I guess an extension of that question would be, I would imagine that these agreements, you know, from an enforcement perspective, are very different by different countries and different jurisdictions around the world, right? So you're early in this process where you're templatizing these agreements, but you don't have any enforcement issues. So can you just talk about, you know, what you would be able to accomplish in terms of an efficiency perspective without kind of the smart contract, without the NFT, and what the NFT really allows for in kind of this first pillar in this triangle that of kind of the molecule business model?
Let me start by saying that we are at like the Netflix mailing DVDs stage of what I think is going to be like a long chain of innovation that eventually ends with patents being completely irrelevant, meaning that we're going to have an intellectual property system that doesn't rely on monopolistic enforcement, but rather is more akin to what happened with open source software, in that new business models entirely are going to emerge around drug development. But in the interim, what we're trying to engineer, I think, is the transitional state between this very monopolistic system and this open source system. Currently, the IP NFT is relatively simple. You can think about this as a box that I can put any series of legal documents in, right? And like, depending on the engineering of the underlying documents themselves, so the real world legal agreements, that is going to materially affect many things around the IP NFT, how transactable it is, how tradable it is. And what we've tried to create is basically, doing IP transactions in the real world is very frictionful. It has a high cost associated with it. It has a high legal cost, a lot of diligence. And so this is a Web2 innovation, first off, meaning that like there's a legal innovation here, which is just basically trying to standardize these agreements in a way that enables less frictionful transaction. And that can be as simple as adding a clause that says like, this agreement is going to be sublicensed to a wallet address. And when that wallet address changes in this smart contract, the new owner is going to be assigned. Like, and so you basically, at a first pass, you're not really doing anything that is that innovative other than decreasing the friction of transacting IP. But now where it gets interesting is sort of by making IP a digitally native asset. Like, data is a digitally native asset. It didn't used to be. It used to be like at NIH, there's like cabinets that you open that are full of data. That's like even still a reality in some places. For the most part, we've made it a digital asset. So like, before we focus on like the fact that it's an NFT, let's think about the first layer of this is like, how do we make intellectual property? How do we make patents? How do we make rights to patents a digital asset that can be discovered, that can be priced, that can be transacted in, right? And so that doesn't require the thing being on chain, but there's a bunch of other reasons why we want it to be on chain, which I'll get to in a second, which are basically have to do with market discovery, price discovery, certain transaction patterns that are like, so currently, like if I want to, NFTs are really interesting because I could do things like programmatic royalties. I could do things like fractionalization. I can take this piece of intellectual property, I could put it into a fractional vault, and I can spit out an ERC-20 token that represents ownership or proxy, or let's say revenue drips in anything that contract gets. So what we're trying to do initially is like make IP digital so people can transact in it, so that we can have liquidity around it. But then the next stage is like, we also want it to be composable. And we also want to do something that hasn't really been done. But again, it's, you know, there's, I would talk more about like the arguments for why like decentralized storage and decentralized data storage is important. Like, but we also want to link together the intellectual property and the underlying data, meaning that like at some point, if I file a patent, if some point I want to prove that the asset that I have is valuable, the thing that's really important is that there's a huge amount of data that has been discovered around this asset that is going to be part of the process of convincing other people this is valuable, or even claiming intellectual property rights on it. And so normally those things are really, really disintermediated, meaning that like the patent is this sort of amorphous legal document that lives somewhere in a particular jurisdiction. And then in someone's lab, there's a bunch of data. We want to put those two things together. And the way that we do that in the current context is that the NFT itself is basically the key that unlocks access to a decentralized storage layer that contains the underlying data around the asset. So what we've done in this context and why it's interesting is that we now have this unit of intellectual property that is natively digital, that is transactable, that is linked to relevant data around the asset itself. And you can imagine this over time, in and of itself, without a patent, becoming the actual store of value, meaning that, okay, there's now this thing that's moving around that different people have ownership in, that different people have access to. You can trace all of that. Every time somebody accesses the data, it's measurable on chain. What happens, there's sort of a chain of events. Patents are basically somebody saying like, look, I discovered this. I'm the first one that did it. And like then stamping a legal document out of it. Blockchains are also pretty good at showing like, you know, something that originates and then a chain of behaviors and interaction patterns downstream, right? Because of this being a sort of the way that ledgers work. So we are imagining a future where that, you know, it's not just a proxy for a real world legal document or something like this, but rather that intellectual property itself is now coupled to data and is financializable in a sense, right? It becomes an instrument for financial value capture and distribution and revenue, all as a programmatic asset.
Cool. Awesome. Great explanation. And then the second element, the marketplace, right? What elements there? I mean, is that really just a Web2 thing where you're essentially building kind of the taxonomy, the classification, you know, or are there elements of kind of smart contracts and blockchain that, you know, if we isolate kind of the IP and NFT and we isolate the DAOs, right, demand and supply bootstrapping, could you do the marketplace without this kind of the technologies that have arisen over the last 5 years?
We're still in a phase where, like, you know, we're in this V1 of the marketplace that is mostly focused on asset discovery, showing research projects and things like this. The V2 is basically, you know, which is probably shipping sometime in the next 6 months. There's still a lot of legal that's being resolved around this, but like, there's also going to be fractionalization sort of built in. So like, for example, you know, it might be what is interesting would be bringing together like a syndicate or patient collective, or spinning up a DAO in the sense that like you get a group of people together that are now funding this asset on the marketplace. And that you might be doing that by, for example, putting the IP NFT into a research contract that then spits out ERC-20 tokens. We call them friends and fam, that are basically two classes of fractionalized asset ownership. One that's for basically like KYC'd institutional or accredited investors, which really gives exposure to like underlying revenue or to these people have ownership rights in the asset. Another one called friends, which is more basically a group of people that get to suggest ethical encumbrances for pharmaceutical companies. And so this is basically creating a relationship between one class of fractional owners that, you know, could be, again, more institutional grade, and one class that is like maybe the general public patients, for example, that should have a right to like govern or make suggestions to that other class of owners. And so right now the marketplace is, I would say it's pretty much fully Web2, with the exception of there's this IPNFT module where people can bid on IPNFTs similar to like an OpenSea-like market. I suppose that could also be done in a two-way, but the features that are coming, fractionalization, DAO formation, syndicate formation, and the way that we want to do that will be on-chain native.
Amazing. I imagine reputation will come into play over time as well. Maybe you guys don't do that, but just your contributions in such a
way. Yeah, reputation will be a really important thing. I think one thing that's really important to understand that like is maybe a principle around how we're building and why we're building this way. So like the thing that we wanted to do initially, rather than, you know, there's things that we could probably do that are more innovative, meaning that we could say that like, you know, if we were less critical about like what we want to happen right now is that if somebody sues someone that bought an IP NFT, like the legal owner of this, that the way that would be dealt with in the court is completely analogous to how it would happen in the real world right now. Meaning that like, we're not a DeFi protocol in that like, I have to go and convince a university that the legal backend behind this IP NFT contract is actually going to hold up in the real world, right? So like, instead of doing we're basically engineering right now to be compliant and to interface directly with universities, with law firms, making sure that like this technical backend and this stack that we're building, patents, the value of a patent is really, it only matters when there's litigation, right? Like if somebody wants to enforce that patent, that's what that thing promises. And we need to make sure right now that we can do that. So I think, you know, there's going to be a lot more legal innovation when we get into slightly fringier areas with this. And all of a sudden when the IPNFT stack is a permissionless protocol that anyone could mint something to and then begin like sharing data with other people. And then maybe they don't have IP yet, but maybe there's an agreement between two parties. And this is happening in a way that is like disintermediated from universities. I think we'll see a lot of other people bring really interesting innovation in. But what we're trying to build at Molecule right now is basically a very compliant way for DAOs, for communities to really own material intellectual property out of universities with a long-term plan of changing the system.
Well, and I would imagine if you take this to kind of its logical limit, right? What you were saying earlier about kind of patents going away, if all of your stuff's on chain, if all the underlying data is on chain and your reputation about what you've contributed to is on chain, then you don't really need the patent, right? Because effectively you've built in this kind of reputational system that supports the kind of shared rights around that IP in a way that, as you mentioned, kind of the institutional framework of nation states contributes to kind of enforcement of the patents today. So let's get into the kind of the third element of this, which is the supply side and demand side bootstrapping. And I really went deep on your governance structure because I think you guys have put a lot of thought into it. I thought it versus other things I've seen really well thought through. So let's talk about VitaDAO a bit. So what is VitaDAO?
So VitaDAO is a decentralized autonomous organization that is working to fund and incubate early stage longevity therapeutics. And it is composed of a couple different, let's say, classes of actors. One would just be we have token holders in this context, which is inclusive of every class that I'm going to say above this. And maybe class isn't the right word, but just sort of user group or stakeholder, right? So like everyone in this organization is a token holder, but not all token holders contribute this the same way, let's say this. And so on one hand, the collective idea here is that we are trying to mimic successful execution patterns in biotech, right? Meaning that the goal of this organization is ultimately to bring drugs to market to combat longevity, treating aging as a disease. You know, there's many different, we don't need to get into the weeds on like why longevity unless you want to. And there's obviously many different schools of thought here, but I'm really attracted to this area because I believe it's going to be a paradigm shift in how we do medicine. I believe that it's much more preventative focused than, you know, a lot of the research that's being done is like, you know, as I mentioned before, if we can like figure out a way to just bolster DNA repair capacity or avoid DNA damage, we might be able to avoid cancer, for example. And so this is the groups of people that are a part of VitaDAO, or I would say are people who are general enthusiasts about aging, who believe in aging, you know, the type of people who would maybe join the Reddit longevity subreddit. Then there's an entire other group, which I would say are more hardcore academic types. These are people who actually now work in working groups in VitaDAO. This is how the DAO is structured. There's a legal working group, a longevity working group, you know, tokenomics, operations, et cetera. But the longevity working group is probably the most interesting and probably something that's not conserved between other DAOs, which is basically a community of MDs, PhDs, people with deep domain experience in the context of aging research. And what this collective does is it works to identify interesting research, source it, evaluate it, due diligence it, incubate it, go back and forth with the researcher, understand what the pathway is to intellectual property. It's not a grant funding body. VitaDAO is trying to do commercial research, meaning translational research, stuff that tries to create products. That's not to say it doesn't also do some philanthropic work and donations and things like this. We also participated in a Gitcoin round. We also have a fellowship program. We also have a longevity prize. But the core of what the DAO does is basically via this IPNFT framework, identifying interesting research at universities or even disintermediating it from universities with a program called Decentralized Tech transfer, incubating assets alongside researchers, and then trying to move them closer to market. And from a governance perspective, we have a system that I would say is strongly suggested by experts, meaning that there's a group of trusted people in VitaDAO that make up this longevity working group. They are by no means the final say. The token holders are, but with every project that is reviewed, they make a recommendation, meaning they evaluate the science on a bunch of different axes, you know, the quality of the team, the intellectual property, the merit of the project, the potential impact, the feasibility. They then put together a report. That report goes to the community, the broader token holder community. This is inclusive of everyone now. And then people vote on whether or not they want to fund a research project. And that's sort of like, what's interesting is that alone is a difficult feat for a DAO to accomplish. You need to work with universities. You need to work with lawyers. It's very, there's, you know, a bunch of strings that you're sort of pulling on at the same time. But then the real work actually begins after the research is funded. Now this DAO is basically working together with a researcher.
One second here, Tyler. So I just want to like really hone in on what this kind of group does, the groups of kind of MDs and PhDs, because when models like this have been tried to be decentralized before, when you talk about actually funding things, like normally you have a principal, right, who's taking going really, really deep. And so I'm just wondering how this team works together. Like, do they appoint someone who's kind of the principal on a particular deal, and that person goes really deep, and then they share with others? Like, what does this process actually look like?
Yeah. So we call them shepherds and deal champions and things like this. But yeah, so you can imagine that this group, this longevity working group, let's stick with the VitaDAO use case. Let's say it consists of about 100 different people who all have some different domain expertise in the context of aging research. And the domains that they come from are different. So some people are academics that can evaluate the science. Some people have a background in VC and deal flow. Some people have a background in company building, entrepreneurs, et cetera, right? And so we create from within that group what are called deal squads, which might consist of one senior reviewer, two junior reviewers, one person who has built companies, another person who's an intellectual property lawyer, for example, from the legal working group. And these basically create like little, we call them squads, that then work to do diligence a deal, work with the researcher, improve the application in most cases. One interesting thing to note is there has never been a project that was accepted by VitaDAO on the basis of the application alone, meaning that every single project, even the best ones, typically needs some amount of work with an IP lawyer, with the community to get into a shape where they're eminently fundable. And by eminently fundable, I mean where there is a very well delineated pathway that if we follow these experiments and if we structure an agreement with the researcher and the university in this way, it is likely that VitaDAO will be able to capture something of value. And this is super important because the mechanics of the DAO are such that basically all of the, if VitaDAO is ever successful from an asset commercially, that money goes back into the treasury and funds research. And that's the actual innovation here. This is what enables it to become sustainable. It's an interesting hybrid between philanthropic and for-profit in the sense that it's more like an endowment. It can perpetually, if successful, fund longevity research in perpetuity. But so these deal squads, that I'll just describe end-to-end the process. It's really laborious. It's even more laborious, I would say, in a sort of Web2 non-DAO context. And the superpower of these DAOs are their network effects. So it's the ability to scale and incentivize a network of academics and researchers from all over the world to give their time to the organization. But what happens is someone applies or a deal is sourced. A squad forms with people who have native experience or domain expertise in the subfield of longevity. Let's call it autophagy, for example. Those people evaluate the deal, that we bring in an IP lawyer. We begin to look at like, okay, what is the intellectual property here? How is this going to move forward? What does the market look like? What does the competition look like? What is the composition of the team? What does the budget look like? How much money do they need? Why do they need that much money? What is the university overhead? This is happening. There's a dialogue happening during that time between the researcher, between the working group. Maybe you shouldn't design the experiments this way. Maybe it makes more sense. And, you know, researchers think about publishing as their endpoint. They don't think about products. So they might want to run the same series of experiments in three different models when it's probably unnecessary. So there's a bit of a dialogue about this. In the background, Molecule, my organization, is typically negotiating directly with the tech transfer office. So now beginning to have a conversation around like, what are the terms of this deal? What does the licensing agreement look like? If this is successful, what percentage does the university get, if any? Should we actually just purchase the asset out of the university? What is their incentive long-term to be a part of this? Should we actually just hire the researcher as a 20% consulting and do experiments in a different way that disintermediate it from the university through decentralized tech transfer? anyway, at some point we know this is the scope of experiments that want to be done. This is the deal that we have with the researcher. The IP NFT is minted with this legal agreement, with this scope of research. VitaDAO then purchases the IP NFT. Money flows to the researcher. They kick off their work. They begin on a monthly basis reporting data to the DAO. The DAO is reviewing that data. And now, so you're getting into like the incubation phase. So now the DAO is that longevity working group is looking at the results that are actually coming in from the research project, which can come in different forms, a monthly update, sort of report on like, we did, you know, let's stick with the autophagy example. We looked at three different cell lines that have impaired autophagy. We treated with these three drugs. Drug X produced a positive effect. Okay, let's stick with drug X. We want to now deal with the next series of assays that we want to do. Okay, we have $150,000. We can design these and these experiments, or these are the ones that we decided on in the agreement. That is progressing and moving along. And again, it's a dialogue between the community. At some point, there's a question around like, what now, what next? So this progresses, the asset moves downstream. And this is sort of where we are now in VitaDAO. We've sort of gone from like zero to one of, cool, we can work with universities, we could fund research, we could do early stage incubation. Now the next step is, the reality is that drug development is extremely expensive. There's not enough liquidity in DeSci to fund even the early stages of like one drug to the clinic. It costs between $800 million and $2 billion to develop a single therapeutic. So we are basically at the stage that we are now doing like preclinical de-risking of therapeutics. And then we need to partner with other organizations. We need to out-license therapeutics to other organizations. There's been this really interesting use case where, you know, Pfizer is investing in VitaDAO, and they're going to have an extremely small stake. But this is their first bet in longevity. And you could think maybe that it's quite antithetical to the entire thing. Like, why bring in a pharmaceutical company? But what is really interesting here is that you have a community that is now dictating the terms on which Pfizer works to an extent, right? So if Pfizer wants to actually interact with this DAO, if they want to meaningfully help with an asset, they have to do it on terms that are basically set by this community, and their governance stake is extremely small. So we are still reliant on, something has to happen with this drug, right? It wouldn't be useful if we just got it to a point and then there's no money, there's nothing left. What do we do? So we have to work with the incumbent system. We have to basically now transition into a state where the DAO is a partner with a pharmaceutical company, or the DAO creates a lightweight biotechnology company that goes and raises money. And you can think about like the people who are part of that DAO as meaningfully, you know, having a seat on the cap table. But we're still very early stage. We're still trying to de-risk things. And the vision is that eventually decentralized science has all of the pillars and all of the necessary components to do end-to-end drug development, decentralized clinical trials, contract research organizations that are providing services. But we're in the very early stages of the development of this ecosystem. And what we have currently are these sort of early stage funding and incubation bodies.
The perfect segue, because I was going to ask you kind of in the limit of this, right? If you guys are successful, or when you're successful and achieve this vision, what is the role of the university?
Yeah, so I probably have a slightly more controversial opinion on this than others. And I also don't want to like alienate universities, but universities are archaic structures in that like science does not need to organize on the principle of like this legacy institution in one location, right? Like, how should science be organized? Like, DAOs are really interesting, right? Because there's people from all over the world that have an interest in longevity that are joining VitaDAO, and they're doing it so on the basis of their values and their principles, not on the basis of like, yeah, Harvard gets like, it, I mean, I'm not going to bash universities, but I imagine an entire disintermediation from universities, meaning that the education systems, the science, all of this of the future is not something that is based on what university you are, but it's going to be based on your values. It's going to be based on what you want to create, the type of people that you want to work with. And obviously universities intrinsically select for these things, right? So maybe like, you know, there's certain universities that have a certain set of values and that attracts people, but it's still weirdly tied to like geography, right? I actually have to go to this place and live there and like work in a laboratory there. And, you know, like, of course there's global networks and people collaborate, but I think increasingly, if DeSci is successful, what this looks like is like anyone, anywhere in the world with a laptop and skills that are vetted by the community, not skills that are like, hey, you published in paper in Nature and that was like high impact, but rather like, hey, this person, I don't care if they're a 16-year-old kid, is really good at running assays and doing this particular experiment. We know they're good because we can verify the data and it doesn't really matter who's behind it, right? It's like completely, let's throw out like everything about you other than the fact that you're like good at doing this thing. That's probably how things are going to organize, and reputation and impact really becomes like the value that people add, right? It's not about posturing, and it's challenging in the sciences because, you know, there's a lot of things that DSci can't solve. There are a lot of cultural challenges in the science, meaning that like prestige is one of the most motivating things in academia. This is like what people care about. They want to be like, academia is like an egotistical bunch on the basis that like the thing that we care about most is like, I publish a paper in Nature, my impact factor is this, my peers look at me this way, I won this prize. It's like actually a different, it's not like financial motivation, it's like prestige, right? So this is a big challenge for DSci as a total aside, like thinking about how do we bring that currency into the space, or do we even want to, or would we rather just select for a group of people who think differently about it?
Yeah, I think that's a very important point because I have thought about, this is why I was super interested in what you guys are doing at the beginning, because I've been thinking about this for years, since about 2016, where I was like, you know, putting publications on a blockchain is something that at least 25 different groups of people have thought about in terms of like starting a company, trying it out and like seeing where it goes. And I think that you're butting up against something extremely on point, is that all of those things fail because they mostly fail to understand that that publications are driven by prestige and career advancement, right? And so no one is going to leave your little, their little enclave to publish on your blockchain. They don't care. Archive is a weird thing that like is a great example of something that's possible, but it's just like, you have to study something. You have to study for a while, man. It's something that we need to bake in everything else. Like they have their own prestige or something.
I'm like the most bullish person on decentralized science. Like I have to be up there in like the top five most bullish people. And I still like, given the opportunity to publish on like one of these new decentralized publishing platforms or like have a paper in Nature, I'm still like gagged to like, I'll take the Nature publication. Like, and this is because, I mean, we do have egos and we do care about our reputation. And I do like, that is the reality. And like people who say that they're beyond that and above that and don't care, like prove it by doing the work. Like, and I have an example of this. Like when I was at NIA, there was an HHS competition to basically try to do something innovative that would make the institution, let's say, more robust or more efficient. And so I initially had working with another postdoc, I had an idea that we should create an internal journal for the publication of negative results, right? And so that seems like obvious, like a total no-brainer. Like, of course, why not? Like, why would you not want to share your negative data? And why would you not want to avoid redundancy? Well, like, there's actually a ton of reasons why not. Like, the reason is because you don't know why you're wrong. Is it a technical error? Is it biological variability? Did you design your experiments poorly? Are other people going to judge you for that? Was it stupid? Is your hypothesis dumb? Did the experiment really not work? Or did you just not pipette properly? Maybe you should, like, run the experiment three more times. And then, like, it's like, okay, so, like, what if it's anonymous? Then like maybe people do it. And then it turns out that like, you know, this is something that you see in the HIPAA space and the healthcare data space. It's like extremely easy to identify people based on the types of experiments that they run. Like at a certain level, especially intra-institutionally or like in the NIH, I can look at someone's experiments, even if it's completely de-identified, and be like, yeah, this is definitely this person in this lab, or at least one of these three people. And the reality is that the, you know, people want to be right. People, negative data is, it's like getting to this vulnerable, exposed part of like the human condition, which is like, we need to be like openly willing to fail. We need to be openly willing to be wrong. Nobody likes to be wrong. Nobody likes to be a person that didn't design an experiment, right? But like, you know, it's this chain of people reinforcing unilateral career mobility, the ability to get a tenure track position in academia by basically selecting for a set of criteria. So like, if it's going to be the case that like to be a tenure track professor at Harvard, I'm going to need to have published in Nature, PNAS, Science, or Cell, like that system is going to keep being perpetuated.
Just to push back on that, Tyler, you know, like and maybe you were just about to say this, and sorry for interrupting you, but the reason why most researchers and academics want to do that is just so that they can do more research and not have to be bothered with anything else. They want the tenure to be able to do it. So if you create the liquidity and you create the ecosystem that allows them to create reputation, find other collaborators, and then commoditize all the stuff that doesn't matter, like the labs, right? I can easily find a lab anywhere in the world. I know the price. 100%. Right.
So this is what I was going to get to at the end of that chain. So the person, like, you know, the person who wants to publish the paper in Nature, like, why do they want to publish the paper in Nature? Like, prestige is one side of it. What does that prestige translate to? It translates to a tenure track position in academia and probably the ability to continuously get more funding for your laboratory in this sort of prestige funding cycle. And so how do you break that? Like, I think one component is definitely, so if there was $10 billion in DSI and you come here, you submit your application, you get funded, I think there would be a massive, massive, like, yeah, seismic shift away from academia into the space. But I do think that there still is a component that we haven't really solved yet, which is, you know, is it funding alone or are there deeper incentives there? And I think, you know, there's a bunch of things that we need to think about in terms of, like, what I was going to say is there's also, I think, scientists in general, especially senior ones who have already made their career and, like, their positions are not threatened. They don't need to worry about getting tenure anymore. It would be great if people in those positions started behaving in the way that they would want these future generations to behave, which is as simple as, like, yeah, maybe do publish your outputs in, like, an open source journal. Maybe do make your negative data available for other people to see, like, especially if you're in a tenure track position, you have nothing to lose. But there's also a lot of reasons why, like, hard to teach old dog new tricks. It's probably going to be mostly young people that change the system. So yeah, it's complicated, but agree with your point in that, like, if there was sufficient liquidity here, that is the probably driving and organizing principle that is going to get most meaningful scientists to join this cause.
Yeah. And I think on top of that, the marginal stakeholder incentives that you're creating that will become increasingly programmatic over time that lead to allocations of VITA, right? The token, you're essentially creating this ETF in the future of science. And so I'm incentivized to start doing things I might not be incentivized to do, like share my failures, right? Because effectively, like, it doesn't really matter if I fail because I'm part of this system. I'm going to keep trying. And I'm going to get essentially a share of everyone else's success in the ecosystem as well. And so that's what I think becomes really powerful about this over time. One of the things that I think you guys have done phenomenally well for, you know, we talked to a lot of DAOs, and I think one of the challenges around DAOs is, like, trying to really figure out what decentralization means. And I think you guys have really in the past year, just in going into kind of the governance, have figured out some of the safeguards to ensure that you maintain kind of this decentralized structure, but at the same time have these kind of rails around it. And so I wanted to go into some of the things that have happened in governance because of kind of the success that you've had in setting this up. So one of the things that I think is important to first think about in terms of the stage that you guys are at, you raised money at, you know, a sub $100 million kind of a Series A recently, or you know, 6 months ago. And I think VITA has just gone through another fundraise, right? Or you guys just closed into Marvel, and then you closed into VITA, right? And now VITA itself has about 1,300 token holders, right? And so I think, like, one of the interesting things to think about is in a Series A startup versus in kind of even at this early stage, what are the dynamics of decentralization of the ownership that you're seeing, like, within the first year of setting this up?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's a really interesting question. At a first level, like, I don't want to say I'm not a decentralization maxi, but I will say that, like, one thing that crypto is not great at sometimes is, like decentralization predates centralized governance, right? Like, if you go back into the history books and you understand, like, how these structures evolved, like, centralization was a reaction in that sense. And decentralization today is a reaction in some cases to problems that come intrinsically with centralized authorities. But I think there's some things that can be decentralized really effectively, really quickly, and where it makes sense. And I think there's some things that, like, it absolutely makes sense to have a strong focused group of people bringing something into the world for a period of time, right? And so, like, with Molecule is still a company. It's an AG. Molecule is the vision of a few people that are driving this right now. And up to the point where, like, I want to be sure that, like, at the point when there are other people controlling this, that the vision that I have for this and that other people have for this is realized. And it's similar with VitaDAO. Like, VitaDAO has progressively decentralized from day one, but there's still, and go talk to any DAO, you'll see there's always a core group of people
who are really doing the work. And this is not only a function of decentralization, it just is the reality of like, you need continuity, you need accountability. You know, there are some functions where a governance contributor who's showing up once a week can add value. And then there's other places where like you actually need people who are working 8 to 10 hours a day to like make a thing function. And so what we've tried to do that I think we've been very successful with is figuring out what the balance between those two things look like. And so an example of progressive decentralization in VitaDAO is like the longevity working group. There's this network of academics that's providing a really strong, consistent function. But there's also a group in VitaDAO that's like slightly more centralized, which is VitaCore. And VitaCore is not, you know, there's nothing special about this group other than it's the people who are committed full-time to, you know, or nearly full-time or some sort of close to full-time equivalent working on VitaDAO. And they initially were not, you know, elected. It's people who were building the DAO sort of from day one. And increasingly we realize that like there's challenges that come with that, right? So like this is an organization that is, you know, at the end of the day, it's public in the sense that it does have to answer to token holders. There does need to be a clear process for onboarding and offboarding people. And so we are currently in a process right now, which I think I'm not super deeply involved in, but you can probably follow in like the governance forum and stuff like that, where there's been some tension between like, what is the process for steward offboarding? How are stewards elected? There's different proposals, almost competing proposals for this that I think are interesting. And it's something that we're thinking a lot about on the basis that, you know, what is interesting is that you have people who create a huge amount of value for VitaDAO, but they work very much in the background. So let's say someone who's working in operations, right? They're not necessarily a public figure in the DAO, but they're somebody who's ensuring that on a day-to-day from an operational capacity that DAO is running. And if you think about the systems that crypto has tried to use to incentivize, let's say something like Coordinate, for example, it's like, cool, who's adding value in the DAO? Well, this person does something good, I give them some tokens. This person does something good, I give them some tokens. Everyone's sort of giving each other tokens for doing good things. Everyone gets incentivized. You could sort of see at the end, like a picture of what it looks like. The problem with this is that it actually over-indexes on visibility to other participants, right? So it's like the people who would be most incentivized to like receive tokens in VitaDAO might be like, I'm like a public figure associated with VitaDAO. A lot of people associate me with VitaDAO, but actually in reality, like on a day-to-day, I'm building Molecule. I'm not intimately involved in a huge amount of things that are like making VitaDAO work. I'm not the person who should have asymmetric power in VitaDAO. I'm not the person who should be overly incentivized. There's a bunch of people in the background that people have never heard of that are doing the real work of actually building this organization. So how do you create the right context between the community and these people? The answer is it's really hard. It takes time. Governance is reactive. The rules are written in blood. Like we're learning by doing, and you know, we're not LARPing as this massively decentralized entity with, you know, hundreds of thousands of members. There's, like I said, there's a couple hundred people that are part of the working groups. As far as I'm concerned, and this is, you know, maybe I'll regret saying this, but like, for me, the people that matter in VitaDAO are the people that are showing up and putting time into the organization. The people who have the most tokens in VitaDAO are the people who have earned their way to having those tokens. Just for example, the largest token holders in the organization, the people who have spent the most hours working on the DAO. I like this idea. I like the idea that a researcher who's a graduate student could show up at VitaDAO, basically make a living on the side, eventually leave their academic posts. We've had people who have left professorships at top universities in the US to work in VitaDAO. Tim Peterson is a great example. It's a person from Washington University, one of the best medical schools in the country, who is now like one of the stewards of the longevity working group, who's creating a decentralized journal for longevity. This is like, these are the people that are super important. The person who shows up once a month to vote yes or no on a governance proposal is also important. And we also appreciate those people. But in the end, they're, I think, part of like the vision and the mission for this organization, but they're not the person that's going to make it succeed ultimately. And so this is the challenge, right? It's like in this stage where you're still small and you're still early, decentralization is a goal, but it's not the only thing that's important. And I would never prioritize getting in as many people, being as decentralized as possible, over the actual success of the organization. I think this is true in a lot of places in crypto, but I think a lot of people LARP about it, meaning that like, it's like decentralization theater. Yeah. I sort of have strong opinions about this. And again, I'm sort of the, if you look at many other DAOs that are successful, obviously biotech DAOs are a bit different because the functions are so specific and require such deep expertise, but you know, there's often a group of people who are sort of building in the back end. And I think as long as the power of those people is not totally asymmetric to the community, it does make sense to have structures that enable that.
Makes a lot of sense. And some of the things, you know, I think there's just that whole thread goes to kind of the how far behind a lot of the regulators are on this, right? And how important it is that we get to a safe harbor, right? Because effectively, there is this tension between centralized and decentralized structures. There is a time for decentralization, and the entire regulatory and the gray regulatory environment leads to this kind of the design of non-competitive ventures, right? Because you're optimizing for decentralization before this should happen. But some of the things that I think that you guys have done really well, so I think like if you go into the governance documents, we can just go quickly into this and kind of wrap up. Yeah. But some of the things that I think you guys have done really well is, you know, the onboarding of stewards. I think you talked about the early process, but now I think you have a really well thought out process. And so yeah, people should really look into that. The offboarding of stewards, you know, is one area where I think like, I still don't get how this works in a decentralized fashion, because there's going to be these periods where you have a company where you might have a leader of a function or a division, or even like a CEO, where they're just making a completely unpopular decision, right?
Yeah.
I think of like, and maybe this is a good, you know, a good example, but if I was with Shackleton and he told me to eat the dogs, I'm just not sure that I would eat the dogs, right? Yeah. And so like, he's like, but like that was the right decision at the time, yeah, right? So, you know, I think like that's one area where you've created this kind of Vita core, where this is almost like a super advisory board that can essentially say, look, if none of the other functions matter, we can essentially get rid of a steward based on this kind of core group of students. Almost acts like a board, I think was a really interesting innovation. A couple of questions that
say that I literally just finished the book. I'm not sure if you've heard of it. Do you know the book Endurance? It's about Shackleton's.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Insane. Like, it's funny that you mentioned that just because I, such an amazing story. But anyway, carry on. Sorry.
Yeah. The guy was like dirt poor his entire life, right? I mean, yeah, it's really, insane. Really just like, I mean, he had some problems, but yeah, you know, a really good kind of inspiring leadership story. Right? So, I mean, I'm not sure like you'd want to be his friend, right? But like, oh, like no, maybe no, you no. want to go to the Antarctic with him, like, yeah, two times, right?
Exactly.
So I think like maybe we could, one of the areas that like I'm always trying to think about the limit of things, like so when things kind of grow and scale. And one of the things that I was trying to figure out in the governance is what happens if someone comes in and kind of buys all of the tokens. So like if there's like, you know, Pfizer comes in and says, you know, we're just going to buy the entire token cap table on these kind of.
It's game over, man. We pack our bags. We go home. We say like, good job. Everyone tried their best. No, I mean, there's a few like, so from a technical perspective, there's just the reality of like the token distribution, right? So like, where do the tokens live right now? Like if you went onto the market and bought every token that's available for sale in VitaDAO, you would have like less governance power than the working groups. You would have less governance power than multiple organizations. 30% of the total token supply has been minted. 10% is sitting with basically contributors, working group members. 10% was sold in an initial auction, and 10% lives with service providers who are just folks like Molecule, like Decentralized Matter, like Kiko that actually built the organization and basically worked at risk to create it. So it's just technically not possible. Now you could ask another question, like what if Pfizer went around and like coerced everyone into like selling their tokens? I mean, there's reasons that can happen because of vesting, but at some stage it's conceivably possible. I think the goal is really just to make sure that there is sufficient decentralization. Like it's sort of like what would happen if like, you could ask the question, like, I guess it is sort of happening a little bit. Like, what if like Sam Bankman-Fried buys all the ETH? Like, I don't know what the analogous situation is. It's a hard thing to do if a system is sufficiently decentralized, if there's enough motivated parties that are trying to resist that. I think it would be difficult. These are sensitive, you know, these systems are anti-fragile, but that doesn't mean that they don't have some points of fragility, right? And so you have to assume a certain level of like, I can tell you because Pfizer is participating in VitaDAO, I look forward to the day when Pfizer can like custody their own tokens. Like that doesn't even exist yet, right? We have to basically like set up an equity vehicle for them to like, that has a like custody over a wallet that then holds like
a few thousand Vita tokens. So in terms of like the imminent threat, it's not there yet. But yeah, I would say that the way that we've approached this problem at this stage is more of a token economics distribution problem. Now, when in the future, when additional tokens are minted, you always need to be mindful of your token holder base, your stakeholder base. I mean, you know, the VCs that you bring in, the behavior that they have. One thing that I'm extremely proud of in VitaDAO is that we genuinely launched through like a fair launch mechanic, meaning that like the team, everyone that built VitaDAO did not have any tokens, right? There was a contract. The token contract was deployed by an anonymous contributor. Those tokens went into a Gnosis auction. Participants basically participated in that auction. A price was set for the tokens. And then the people who built VitaDAO made a governance proposal for them to grant us tokens. So the community could have basically said that no team members, no one that ever built anything at VitaDAO would have gotten any tokens whatsoever. It was really, this is like, there's a couple other projects in crypto that have launched this way. It's a lot of risk associated with it, obviously, but we were always community first. There was not a single VC in VitaDAO. Now the community decided that we're at a stage where we want to continue developing drugs. We need certain specialized expertise from VCs, for example, from pharma. Let's bring in, you know, pharma. And then like Pfizer made, this is for me is, to be honest, mind-blowing. Pfizer made a governance proposal on VitaDAO's governance forum to participate in its institutional round. This is actually a historic moment in crypto. A lot of people aren't aware of this, but you have a traditional pharmaceutical company that is coming in and making a governance proposal on a DAO forum that then the community is like discussing and talking about and decides to like let them in because they think the value that they're adding is worthwhile.
That's VDP 54.1. Is that right?
The fact that you guys know the BDP numbers and not me is
no problem. I'll just put it.
We have nothing to do with our time, Tyler. We're just sitting around.
You're like, this is wild. No, like you mentioned it, I was like, whoa. I do remember hearing about that. So yeah, we'll put that in the show notes. But yeah, I do think, just to stress, that is just crazy, right? That you have Pfizer Ventures going in here going like, we need a governance proposal for this, and there's a guy there from Pfizer.
I also appreciate like there was an article in Nature Biotechnology about VitaDAO and Molecular Decentralized Science, and they're like, it was like one of the articles that they decided like, cool, there's no like paywall on this, we'll make it open. Like it's interesting that like the behaviors of some of these players are being, even if it's very, very small, tangibly affected by the sort of principles that these organizations have, right? And so, but to your question, there's always a risk for, I mean, we've seen it, look at like crypto lately, there's always hostile governance risks, there's always exploitation risks. We've really tried to engineer around that as much as possible. But, you know, if there was an incredibly motivated pharmaceutical company that somehow could also like maybe by convincing enough actors in the system that, you know, that they could buy tokens OTC from people, I don't know, but currently it just wouldn't be possible in the market. Like they could
buy tokens. That will happen at some point in the future, and it's going to set up this really weird scenario where you need to protect against these hostile takeovers, but technically the people that, if it's not algorithmic, right, the people that are protecting against it are technically not decentralized, like, so now they control the asset. Yeah. And like, so it's going to create these really weird M&A scenarios, like in 5 years. Yeah, so,
yeah. And this is like you get into censorship and all these. It's like Pfizer can be an actor in the system, in a permissionless system, the same way as like anyone else, right? Like, and this is like, I mean, we're seeing the limits of this in some ways. It's like I think it's, yeah, it's interesting. Like you could probably go through a bunch of efforts to like censor Pfizer if you wanted to think about it that way. But I'm also not sure that like that's the right approach. For the time being, it's like, you know, where we're focused is like, of course, we're thinking about edge cases. And of course, we're thinking about, you know, where friction might be in these systems in the future. But like my concern as a builder right now is basically proving to the world that we're even capable of going from 0 to 1 and 1 to 10 in this model is materially better than the other model that we have. And I think we still have, for all of the small success that Molecule and VitaDAO and these organizations have, we have a huge, huge, huge amount to prove in front of us, right? And so that's where my head is at the moment. It's like, how do I convince scientists, the world, companies, organizations that are doing this differently, that they should kind of jump ship and do things our way?
Cool. This was awesome. Thank you so much for your time. Let's finish up here. Where should people follow you and your work?
Check out Molecule DAO on Twitter, Vita DAO on Twitter. We just launched a new program called bio.xyz, which is basically like YC for biotech DAOs. If people want to build a biotech DAO, if they want to learn about it, that's the place to do it. You can follow me on Twitter at Glotto Tyler. And yeah, if you're interested in DeSci, come chat to us. DMs are open.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Tyler. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.